Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. On today's episode, I'm joined by probably the biggest metal fan I know personally, Fistful of Dave, and also Martin Popoff, who is basically a hard rock and heavy metal historian. He's written a myriad of books on the subject, and I thought I'd tap into his wealth of knowledge to tackle today's topic, which is, what does heavy mean? And what was the heaviest music of the 70s, and how did that heavy rock music of the 70s evolve into what became known as heavy metal? And when I broached the subject with Martin, he had a lot to say about it, and it was very informative and very enlightening and very interesting, so I hope you enjoy it. Next week, Fistful of Dave will be back, and we will discuss further the heaviest music of the 70s and play a lot more songs by the heaviest bands of the 70s. And basically the goal next week will be to trace the evolution, sort of the heaviest rock and roll from the late 60s and across over the course of the 70s, and how that genre of heavy metal developed. But for now, let's enjoy the conversation that Dave and I had with Martin Popoff.
Good. How are you doing, Martin?
Good.
And I think, Martin, between David and myself, we probably own almost all of your books. So,
good job, guys.
Yeah. So my idea for this episode, I thought first to talk about just what does heavy mean, you know? And Martin, you've probably given a lot of thought to that and talked about it ad nauseum before, I'm guessing. But I mean...
Are you asking me? Is that the first question?
Well, yeah. I mean, what do people mean when they say something is heavy?
Well, you can look at it a few ways. I mean, there are all these different sort of small milestones going back to ancient times or the 50s or the 60s or whatever. I won't go into all of that, but, you know, the first extreme vocal, the first use of feedback, the first use of distortion, the first power chords, but I think the base definition of heavy metal is music that is centered around a guitar that's put through a distortion pedal. Now, that could be making power chords or making riffs. And usually that's accompanied by a good 4/4 beat, and usually it's also accompanied by some pretty extreme vocals. But, you know, if netting out all these milestones of like who was singing extreme in the 50s, or Link Ray and distortion and, you know, a knife through a speaker cone or an amp falling off of the back of a truck causing distortion or any of that stuff. Well, this is a little bit like that, because Dave Davies is one of those stories of possibly cutting a speaker cone. But, you know, the first heavy in a certain extent, you know, another area is surf music. But I guess the first one that people talk about is You Really Got Me and All Day and All the Night, which are power chord songs from the mid-60s. Not particularly riffy, but more like power chords. And moving forward from there, Cream, The Who at times, Jimi Hendrix certainly. You know, that's one of the big milestones, because that's where you get your first guitar hero, Shredder. You know, people even speak of him as being like completely rewriting the rule book, being almost an alien, being someone like literally dropped into the scene that's doing things that nobody could, you know, people barely could comprehend how he was doing it for quite a while. So That's maybe the 60s in a nutshell. To finish the 60s, the first Blue Cheer album, the second Blue Cheer album, the first MC5 album, the first Led Zeppelin album, and actually the second Led Zeppelin album as well, I think, is all 60s. So you start getting songs and even to some extent albums that you could call heavy. And to my mind, I mean, I always think of the first heavy metal band or album or who invented heavy metal. I always like to throw in that thing, well, who really meant it and it wasn't just an accident. With the Beatles, it was a fun little experiment and they came up with Helter Skelter and a couple other riffs here and there. Rolling Stones, same thing. Jumpin' Jack Flash and The Who sounded, you know, heavy when they made a live album, but not that heavy elsewhere. But you start getting albums where there's 3, 4, 5, and to us as kids, the magic level where you actually were a heavy metal album meant over half of it was heavy metal. So to my mind, if you start getting albums that are more than half heavy, those are the guys that are actually inventing heavy metal. I'll stop there and see where you want to go with the next.
Well, I've read the same thing about Dave Davies cutting the speaker cone. And so that when the Kinks came out with You Really Got Me, that was just the most distorted guitar sound that had existed up to that point. Is that true? Or
yes, and I know there's this whole history. Well, no, there's Link Wray and Rumble. It gets talked about. There's first uses of feedback. There's Marty Robbins, I think. There's certain things that happen on Elvis records. There's certain riffy, very riffy things that happen with Dick Dale and surf music. And also, not off the top of my head, but also surf music, I think a guy from surf music invented the first fuzz pedal. So when you actually get somebody making a device that says, hey, let's make this guitar fuzzy, 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 I know Keith Richards is actually one of the first purchasers of one of those or prototype triers of one of those. But I think it came from the Ventures or something. Like some surf guy came up with the first distortion pedals. You could also talk about the invention of the Gibson Les Paul or the invention of the Telecaster, which I believe was called something else when it got invented. But electric guitar, itself is a significant early heavy device. So move forward, you get accidental fuzz, and then you get, real intended fuzz, like people really want this sound.
Yeah, it seems to me a lot of what you're that talking about, all that kind of history stuff, that it more or less influenced on Sabbath and Zeppelin, I guess, for the most along with the blues end of it, kind of. I think that's where it all kind of came together, and it's always, I always have the focal point of like, well, Sabbath is the first one that's just heavy end to end pretty much, and Zeppelin kind of to an extent, but with Iommi's Love of the Shadows and all that kind of a thing, taking all that kind of influence and then adding the tritone to the whole deal.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, I also have this whole argument that heavy metal is invented when you take the blues out of the equation. So basically, there was a big British blues boom, and there were a lot of guys making a lot of noise. John Mayall, Bluesbreakers, Yardbirds, Cream, Hendrix, even to some extent, was a blues band. Sabbath came up with the blues. Rolling Stones was certainly trying to be quite a blues band. They knew that stuff. Even the Beatles were good blues scholars. But so there was this British blues boom, early Fleetwood Mac, Groundhogs. Basically, I think that, I've heard lots of guys say this, that the British blues boom got boring really fast. Zeppelin never kind of left the British blues boom thing. I mean, they did many, many cool things throughout their career, but Sabbath is very different because there's basically the blues, even though they came up on it, the blues was taken right out of the equation. It was more about the tritone and these big doomy chords, but no real blues to speak of. I mean, the bluesiest thing... Right. First Sabbath album, which is, unarguably everybody basically calls it the first heavy metal album. The bluesiest thing on it is a long jammy cover. Right. there's nothing else blues on it. And then basically Sabbath never made anything that you'd have to really construe to call Sabbath a blues band, even though Tony incorrectly calls them a blues band all the time just for fun.
Well, and they say that when they started out, like when they were called Earth, they were a blues band, at least that's how they described themselves, right?
Because they were playing blues covers. They never even wrote any blues originals.
No, right, true.
Basically, they did Rock and Roll Doctor later on. And then the other place where you could argue that they are somewhat of a blues band, and this is somewhat where Tony's coming from, is he can be kind of a bluesy soloist. But other than that, there's nothing bluesy about Sabbath, and that's why they're the first heavy metal band. When you get rid of that, you know, Zeppelin could play loud, garagey blues and turn in something that somewhat sounds heavy metal, or they could do things that are not bluesy that invent heavy metal, like Good Times, Bad Times, Communication Breakdown. Dazed and Confused is an interesting one, though, because that is a link between the British blues boom and metal. But, you know, a lot of the things, you know, Whole Lot of Love, there's nothing really bluesy about Whole Lot of Love. Although, you know, Plant and his phrasings and that. So they always have a connection to the blues.
I think of Immigrant Song as a metal song.
Yeah, 1970 as well. You know, the other band and the other direction you could take this that's very important is heavy metal becomes invented when you add the classical element to it. And that's where you get something like the best heavy metal album, the most modern, the most forceful heavy metal album of 1970 is Deep Purple in Rock. And there you get Ritchie Blackmore and John Lord and putting in these classical elements and the gallop in Hard Lovin' Man. So there's all this stream that goes up through Priest and Maiden and all of power metal that gets invented with something like a Deep Purple. So Deep Purple's a little more classical based. I mean, there's granted not much very classical about Deep Purple in Rock as an album, but well, possibly even the mellowest, the only mellow song on it, in fact. I mean, that album's 6 out of 7 heavy songs. The only mellow song on a Child in Time, you could construe that to being somewhat classical. But no, Sabbath's there inventing doom. February 1970, doomy heavy metal. They're the ones that did it because it is February 1970. Deep Purple does a better and even more heavy metal album, but it's 6 months later. And then Sabbath punctuates the whole thing with an album as heavy as in rock, also in 1970, Paranoid, which has lots of crazy heavy metal on it. So basically, if you had to pick one album, it's Sabbath. If you had to pick one band, it's Sabbath. If you had to split hairs and say, well, if it was invented in 1970, who really did a good job of it? It would be Deep Purple. Got a black friend's Chinese eyes. Got an English brain that's gonna make me wise. Got a long story that I wanna tell. To a rhythm that I can so well. Really got a lot of love that I wanna give. Baby, I'm a mystery, but you know I got it. And he's the second, Ritchie Blackmore is basically the second shredder, the second guitar hero after Jimi Hendrix, in a sense. Tony Iommi never really gets talked about it in that way, nor should he, because he's not trying to do the same sorts of super complicated things all the time that Ritchie is trying to do.
True.
I was thinking about what heavy means, and, you know, it's about distortion mainly, and then volume and the bottom end, right? But what's interesting is it's not about the tempo, you know, because something could be heavy with a very slow tempo or a very fast tempo, but that doesn't really factor into what makes it heavy.
That's true. I mean, we had an interesting discussion, I remember, with Bob Nalbandian and a couple guys about you know, how why did BTO sound heavy to people? Well, it's actually because it sounded like a bunch of fat guys, and Turner's voice sounded belabored and heavy. But you're right, it doesn't have to be fast. And another thing, when you're not fast, it sounds heavy. It sounds like you're carrying a weight around, right? Like a big truck, or you got a big belly or whatever, right? So it means slow and hard of breathing and all that kind of stuff, and really throwing a lot of air into your vocals. I mean, that does make a heavy vocal. An extreme vocal, by definition, is one where you're doing some sort of damage to your vocal cords, and you're blowing a lot of air out. So a really light, fey vocal is not a heavy vocal, because heavy means exertion. It means lifting heavy things, or a heavy voice, or slow, or whatever. A smothering sound, a big bottom end, a fat bass drum as opposed to a clacky bass drum. You know, all of these things add up to heavy. And this is where you get in that discussion with black metal. You know, is a cawing crow voice heavy? Is a blast beat heavy because it's so fast? It's more like just tick, 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 double time, right? So, I mean, does it have a groove anymore? It's too fast to be heavy. It sounds like a bunch of bumblebees. A lot of people talk about, you know, very extreme black metal. Yet they thought they were making the heaviest thing you can possibly make. And obviously when you talk about heavy as well, you can get into the abstract. It's like depressing vocals, depressing lyrics. You know, heavy could be music that is almost suicidal, you know, a Joy Division or a John Cale or whatever, Morrissey or whatever. I mean, you could, you know, any music that you consider very depressing, you could say is heavy.
But that's bringing on that is, you know, Zeppelin kind of brought in a lot of the fantasy lyric, and then Sabbath had the war and nuclear war and God themes kind of that were also that they brought into to make it metal.
I think that's a good point. The lyrical themes and where the standard heavy metal lyrical themes came from. And yeah, you have the two different sides of Sabbath and Zeppelin and the fantasy and then kind of the horror. Or does it have to be dark to be heavy? You know, does the tone or the atmosphere of the song have to be dark?
It helps.
I don't think so, but I mean, it certainly helps. I mean, if you want to put all these components together, sorry about that, guys.
No problem.
Let's see. So where were we? So yeah, I mean, if you put all these components together, I mean, it certainly helps. War and violence and cannibal corpse. I mean, how can you get any heavier than just constantly chopping up bodies and stuff, right? But it's true. Even death metal can sound kind of it can sound kind of mechanized and not heavy. Could sound like too much like just a machine.
Well, yeah, I mean, in my opinion, the first component of heavy is the distortion, obviously, but then to me the next most important component is riffs. You know, riffs are what makes something heavy, and to me death metal, you can't even hear the riff because that's about the tempo. The idea is just to be so fast.
Yeah.
But, you know, something could be heavy with a riff that's at a very slow tempo, but that's, to me, what heavy is the riffs.
Well, okay, I'll get to that in a sec. But the other thing about death metal, which is interesting, I mean, in every department, death metal, black, whatever, thrash, everybody is taking a component of it and saying, what is the most extreme version of this? So their speed, that's one thing, but look at the vocal, the death metal vocal. They're just trying to have the most extreme vocal, and they're positing or arguing that this is the heaviest type of vocal you can do for whatever reason. I mean, and black metal guy with the ka, they think that's the heaviest vocal. And but also death metal, the other reason you can't hear the riffs is they also say, what's the most extreme production we can do? What would be a really extreme production? So they do that. They throw that onto it and say, well, in some way, I'm going to argue after my four beers that this production is as heavy as you can get, right? And no matter what it does, maybe it sacrifices certain things in the sound, but they say, no, this is the heaviest production. And you know, not realizing that, okay, well, maybe we don't really have a bass drum anymore in here, you know? And so is it heavy because we lost the bass drum, right?
Yeah. No, that's part of my issue on the death metal things comes down to, you know, they're tuning down to C sharp or whatever, how low they're going, and then the kick drum that has kind of gone away or replaced with the slappy, clicky kind of drum sounds, which I think kind of takes away from the feeling of it. So
yeah. But, you know, you bring up riff and, you know, riff, it's almost like the bass definition should be more power chords through a distortion pedal. But riffs are important because riffs, you know, for heaviness, it's the power chord. For the definition of making heavy metal music, it's the riff in a certain extent, right?
Right.
So having those complicated riffs, I mean, another way I always talk about it is like the idea that heavy metal is when everybody in the band crouches around, you know, almost like it's an oil drum with a fire in it in the winter, and that oil drum is the riff. So everything gathers around the riff. The riff is the center of the song. It's the most important thing. And quite often, you know, the vocalist has to make up a vocal melody that goes with the riff or whatever, or only he only sings when the riff isn't going, or, you know, or otherwise you have a reason to actually just hear the riff with nothing else going on. Everybody's accompanying it. You know, other people talk about how Metallica, for example, like Metallica is possibly the invention, all, you know, this is a whole different thing, but the invention of metal versus heavy metal. But one of the things about Metallica, they're inventing thrash, right? Well, what is an interesting thing about thrash? Well, one of the interesting things is that the bass player is playing the riff quite often along with the rhythm guitarist. So, you know, it almost like underscores even more the importance of the riff. Like in this music, the riff is so important, the bass player plays the riff as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and going back to Black Sabbath, who are considered basically the first heavy metal band, and the most revolutionary thing about Black Sabbath was the riffs, right? That was what made them so different and so powerful, don't you think?
Yes, but an interesting thing is that Geezer was more or less an old school type bassist who played all sorts of crazy bass parts around the riff, just right, like an old school guy from the 60s or a jammy guy or whatever. I mean, sometimes he played the riff and that made it even underscored it more. But you're right. I mean, but you know, a whole lot of Sabbath songs are not that riffy. I mean, you think of even the song Black Sabbath or the song War Pigs. You know, these are like big stacks of power chords. They have a lot of those. Wizard is not a riff. Black Sabbath, interestingly, the main thing we think of the song Black Sabbath isn't a riff, but it has some riffs in it. It has some total heavy metal riffs, like where it starts going, you know, that's a riff, right? You know, that's not a riff.
Yeah, I think the Sabbath got more riffy after the first two, and kind of more on that middle volume four, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, especially song Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, and Sabotage are a little more, I think, riff-oriented.
And another interesting thing about Sabbath, even though they're sort of the quintessential or the original heavy metal band, Ozzy Osbourne's vocals are not the vocal style that became to be the heavy metal vocal style. Ozzy Osbourne doesn't really fit, you know. That more developed across the 70s, you know.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I've never really thought about this much, but when do you really start getting extreme vocals on heavy metal? Well, a lot of people cite Ian Gillan. He's quite a screamer right out of the gate on In Rock.
Yeah, so right.
He's screaming. He's a much more of a heavy metal vocalist than Ozzy. Ozzy just happens to have high thin pipes, but you know, as you move on, Steven Tyler contributes to the form. The Kiss guys contribute to the form by being a little rough and a little wild and a little screamy. Sammy Hager, Montrose is a really early, you know, I always cite that as a very early modern American party metal album, maybe the album that
sure.
Hair metal, you know, great, great album for 1973, miles ahead of where Aerosmith or Kiss were at that time. Right. It's just like stadium rock right out of the gates. It's quite incredible. That
and
record.
And then of course in the mid 70s, you've also got Rob Halford and then you've got Ronnie James Dio with Rainbow. And that's really, you know, that if you go back to those two guys and then see where heavy metal went in the 80s, you know, that's kind of where the whole generic heavy metal vocal style came from, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't say generic.
It's not the right word.
High style. I mean, there is the high style. I mean,
yeah.
Rob Halford's more of an Ozzy Osbourne. You know, Ronnie had a range where he could grind and also be very technical of a singer as well. But, you know, I think the interesting thing when you get to the mid-70s, if you want to move on, you know, I remember as a kid, I remember how, number one, there weren't a lot of heavy metal albums to get, so you would always go out and risk, we would call it. Like, you'd look at the back cover and see how many long-haired guys there were and make sure there wasn't too much flute mentioned or piano or anything. Like, you'd check the song titles and look for some violence. You know, I remember very distinctly the first three albums that we got as kids that had no mellow songs on it. I thought that was a real harbinger of heavy metal. It's like, wow, these guys mean it even more because there's nothing mellow on these albums. And they would be Rainbow Rising, Sex Pistols, Nevermind the Bollocks, AC/DC, Let There Be Rock, and then later on, basically Motorhead 1 and Motorhead 2 and Motorhead 3. Motorhead had three albums in the 70s, right? And no ballads, right?
Yeah.
So that to me was then, see, now you're getting into, you know, I thought, you're moving on and you're seeing some additional heaviness, but nothing's really changed a whole heck of a lot. I mean, I think the first big step forward for metal, like the first time there was some great strides in terms of making the quality better, would have been Sad Wings of Destiny.
Right.
And even more so on Sin After Sin, and more so even, or equally so on Stained Glass. To me, that's the big leap forward right there, where you get double bass and just complexity and twin leads and all this stuff.
Like, yeah, there was really nothing else at the time that sounded like that. And that's really, when you listen to Sad Wings of Destiny, it's undeniably heavy metal, even compared to 80s heavy metal. And there's nothing really else from that time period that... Well, I think Rainbow Rising is pretty close.
Rising, as great an album as it is, it sounds clunky compared to something like Stained Glass. I mean, Stained Glass is fast and scientific, and Rainbow Rising is just like it's Rainbow Rising is not much of an improvement over Sabbath or the very best Zeppelin songs or whatever. I mean, but the great thing about it, and we loved it right out of the gate, was it's six out of six. It's six heavy songs, right? To my mind, what happens next in the evolution, you want to say what is heavy, is like, when does heavy metal become a package and a visual package, an army, everything all together? And that's basically the new wave of British heavy metal, which starts in about 1979, right?
Right.
Because before that, you know, Foghat and Led Zeppelin and ZZ Top, they wore nudie suits. They wore, you know, named after the guy Nudie who invented those Nashville rhinestone suits and stuff, right? People, Aerosmith looked more or less like the Eagles. You know, everybody, you know, the album covers didn't even look particularly heavy metal. Everything was still somewhat by accident. You kind of vaguely ended up making this power chord riffy music because you liked it, but you know, not everything. You weren't even proud of it. You weren't even talking about it. You know, the term heavy metal was slowly becoming into use. But basically, with the new wave of British heavy metal, which was kind of a reaction to punk and prog and everything, and really, it was a reaction also to Deep Purple breaking up and Led Zeppelin making their mellowest album ever in 1979 and all this, right? So for the first time, you had a jean-jacketed, patched army in their sneakers and their long hair, writing songs about being proud of heavy metal. You know, Saxon and the band played on and, you know, playing my Deep Purple, and he told me to turn it down, and I kicked him and punched him in the face or whatever, right? These Motorhead album covers, the Iron Maiden album cover. You know, basically, you finally had a heavy metal tribe, and that everything was there. It was like a whole little fan club of the album cover, the way everybody dressed, what the lyrics were about, the no ballads ethic, although there were some ballads. But, I mean, if they were ballads, they were more like, you know, spooky epic tales, right? But to my mind, like, that's another nuanced way of looking at who invented heavy metal or where does heavy metal become something. It's like, well, before the new wave of British heavy metal, it was a sound, and that's it. But with the new wave of British heavy metal, it became a complete multimedia package.
I think sound-wise, I think at least what I consider heavy metal is kind of based on either Priest or the Rainbow, the Dio Rainbow stuff, where, you know, the Priest had, like you're saying, they were a little more compact, and it was kind of more of a punch Rainbow tend to be more grandiose and epic in scale, but Priest, I think, pretty much led the way for the new wave of British heavy metal, like kind of shorter, powerful songs, and not that they didn't do some epic pieces, but...
Well, I think the big thing Priest did, more so, is the very, very intelligent riffing, Rob's vocals... Even the lyrics, even the sort of quasi-mystical religious lyrics, and also those very, well-constructed twin leads. So I think those are the most important things that you're right. I mean, they are the precursor to the new wave of British heavy metal. But, you know, in a large sense, it just feels like it's an improvement on Deep Purple in Rock and songs scattered throughout Machine Head and Burn and Fireball. I never thought of that as completely brand new, like a massive invention. I just thought of it as a massive improvement.
Sure.
But the new wave of British heavy metal was pretty varied, and I think had a lot of different influences. I mean, like, to think that Def Leppard and Iron Maiden, they were right there at the same time at the beginning. I mean, what, the first Def Leppard EP came out in like January 79, and I think the Soundhouse tapes was recorded on New Year's Eve of 78 going into 79. So they were both, and they had a totally different set of influences, you know, but I think they also had bands in common. Like, I think both of them were heavily influenced by UFO, don't you think? But then Def Leppard were big on the glam rock stuff, and Iron Maiden were more about the progressive rock. So they had similar influences, but then they had, you know, they had their own tangents, but then it kind of all came together.
Yeah, I don't know. I never really consider... I leave Def Leppard out of the new wave of British heavy metal thing because they are an anomaly. They made two heavy albums and then really started branching out. So just because they became famous, I don't think they need to be talked about in this whole thing. Yes, they were one of the early ones. But basically, you know, Maiden, Saxon, Motorhead, Tigers of Pantang, Quartz, Angel Witch, Fist, Holocaust, Witchfinder General, Witchfind. There were many, many bands doing this stuff. And if you take out the one outlier, Def Leppard, the rest of them are pretty much in that same wheelhouse of basically doing faster, punkier Priest in a certain extent, and even a sort of a Sabbath-y thing. But there's very little real party rock in the whole gamut of new wave British heavy metal. I mean, and then even for old fogey bands, they were in there participating. You had the heaviest Uriah Heep album, the heaviest Budgie album. Gillen as a band, one of my favorite bands of all time. They're a total new wave of British heavy metal band, although, you know, kind of a different style, but
So going back to the early, I wanted to talk about who were the heaviest bands of the 70s, and especially the heaviest bands that maybe a lot of people don't know about, but who were influential on the new wave of British heavy metal and stuff, you know?
We can talk about, you know, influential. It's a pretty short list, and it's pretty easy to figure out who was influential on the new wave of British heavy metal, and that would be Priest, Sabbath, Deep Purple, UFO, Thin Lizzy, certainly. They were a big band over there, and they were making, you know, quite a bit of heavy metal.
Down from the glen came the marching men with their shields and their swords to fight the fight they believed to be right, overthrow the overlords. To the towns where there was plenty, they brought plunder, swords, and flame. When they left, the town was empty, and children would never play again.
It is funny. I mean, these guys over there, they actually don't really talk very much, and it's quite surprising, about Aerosmith or Kiss or Ted Nugent. So it's funny that the bands that were influential on the new wave of British heavy metal were pretty much the bands from over there, you know, from the earlier 70s. Scorpions as well was quite an influence. But once it got going, they started discovering all sorts of metal from all over the place. And that's where, you know, for example, AC/DC, Sammy Hagar, and Riot are like what I would call honorary members of the new wave of British heavy metal. AC/DC spent a ton of time in England around that time, and they were basically participating.
Two-faced woman with your two-faced lie! 'cause you're only one. Why, you've been running around town with every mother's son.
Riot was basically called over there because those guys, you know, were cult into those Riot albums. Accept is another honorary new wave of British heavy metal band, YNT. So these guys went and found all the heavy metal from all around the world because they're actually, it wasn't that hard a job. There just wasn't that much heavy metal to be influenced by. So it's actually a pretty short list of bands who were making heavy metal in the 70s.
So that people were aware of, I guess, is more like you start, like, I knew you wanted to get into, like, BJ had talked about like Toad and some of those bands that are super obscure and I think are more influential on stoner rock from like 2000 on than they were to bands back then.
Yeah, and there's a short list of those too that everybody kind of knows, like Sir Lord Baltimore and Captain Beyond, you know, but I like it a little more so, or I give them more credit when there's a pretty big catalog. There's a band from Australia called Buffalo that had about five albums out, but not, you know, none of these bands were that influential because they were very underground. They didn't sell a lot of records, and plus, you know, I always believe that I try to go the anti-snobby route and say, you know, Sabbath was actually way better than all those bands, and that's why they got to be bigger, or one of the reasons. You know, the system kind of worked in a certain way. These bands didn't get big or didn't put out a lot of albums because they actually weren't that good. So, you know, most of these rarities, these obscurities, are you know, if you take them at face value, they wilt in the face of a Sabbath album or a Priest album. There's not a lot of stuff that is super amazing stuff. There's some heavy kraut rock, you know. I remember even their names escape me because most of these bands did not make more than one or two albums, and they were very derivative. I mean, they were heavy, and they're known to us now quite often simply because they did like Sabbath themselves and were trying to copy Sabbath or whatever. But you know, Blue Oyster Cult's another band that was a very obscure, strange kind of heaviness, but they did have some influence. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty short list. Even you go past the famous bands. I mean, one of my favorite heavy '70s albums is Ram Jam, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Ram. But that's, you know, that's a really cool heavy album. But it's 1978. It's pretty late. Another one is Heavy Load's Full Tilt at High Speed, or whatever it's called, or High Level. You know, that's 1979. Very heavy album. But again, it's 1979. You know, if you want to really, you know, take a hard line and look at what are the heaviest albums of the 70s period, it's probably like Motorhead Overkill, you know, to a certain extent. You have to find an album that there's no mellow songs. It helps if it's got gruff singing, maybe if it's got dirty production. I mean, here we start adding on all our little definitions of what makes heavy. But when you put them all together, it almost becomes like a little mathematical puzzle where you could almost statistically, you know, people don't like when you do that, but if you want to say what's the heaviest album of the 70s, you can apply a little statistical to it and come up with the answer.
Well, what if you just focus on songs, though, instead of have the entire album having to be heavy, you know? And you know, you talked about how the bands weren't influential, the underground bands, but if you think about it, the people that are going to form their own band, they're a big music fan, so they're actually, those are the people that would have dug deeper and would have been a fan. And so maybe a lot of these obscure influences really did affect the new wave of British heavy metal because those guys in those bands were big music fans, and they were the exact people that were going to dig up the obscure bands, you know?
Well, they're going to do that, you're right. I mean, they're going to be the ones who know about those obscure bands, but trust me, I mean, you know, the guys in Cathedral and Witchfinder General and Trouble got a heck of a lot more use out of their entire Sabbath catalog than they did out of two Bang albums, right?
Well, and I think also until, say, when Kerrang became at least available in North America, exposure to some of that stuff just wasn't there. I mean, that's kind of where I got into the regional aspect of it because, you know, you wouldn't know it if you're in a particular region because that's just how it went. There weren't magazines that were covering him until I got some of those, the European magazines and Kerrang being the first, and Metal Forces, I think, even more importantly, you know, at that time, well, exposed.
What could you do in the 70s? You had Cream and Circus and Hit Parader. So you could find out about a lot of heavy stuff that way. And then in the UK, you had the weekly or bi-weekly, I think it was weekly, all, you know, the big massive newspapers, Sounds, Melody.
Sounds, right.
But none of them were really all that into heavy metal until metal took off, and then Sounds was the big champion of that, which begat Kerrang.
Right.
But, you know, the other thing, it's a little bit hard to understand for all of us, but the other thing is the power of the live show. I mean, when this band came through town, that was kind of the way you found out about it as well. Concerts were not that expensive. It was a pretty cool thing when a concert came through. So, you know, I would imagine people are finding out more about bands in the 70s through the live show and their few magazines than the way they do it now, which is, you know, from the internet, you know, watching them make the damn album day by day, you know, right at their site. Right. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it was very hard to find information on all this stuff, and Kerrang was a big service for that because, you know, I grew up in BC and we would go to Spokane, Washington all the time, and that's where we'd buy all our new wave of British heavy metal albums and Kerrang and Sounds, and that's how you found out about all this stuff.
Well, you know, some examples I was thinking about, like, I know I've seen Paul Stanley talk a lot about Blodwyn Pig, that he was a big fan of Blodwyn Pig.
Yeah.
Who were a very obscure band, but like their song See My Way, I really love that song a lot.
I do see my hand and I can help it if I stumble. All of those things that I said before me, wanna see my way. Thank you. so wrong. Climbing mountains without even looking. Wanna see my way.
But then was Bladwin Pig influential? I don't know, but, or, you know, the band Stray, like Iron Maiden covered them. And they were very heavy for the very early 70s.
Yeah.
Or what else was I thinking of? Well, you know, Motorhead comes out of Hawkwind and and Pink Fairies, you know.
Or, yeah.
Or I think a band like Lucifer's Friend, you know, that the first album they did as Asterisk is pretty heavy all the way through, and that's 1970.
Yeah.
And then Ride the Sky, that's also 1970, and that song is, you know, really cool and very close to heavy metal, you know? And then, you know, John Lawton even sounds like Dio, especially on that song, you know.
These isolated things, but I do come back to the idea that if you want to really give someone credit, it's like, who actually liked heavy metal enough to put four or five songs on the album that sound like that? So it's not the Beatles, even though they did Helter Skelter. It's not even Queen, even though they have three or four of the heaviest songs ever of the 70s. You know, Modern Time Rock and Roll, Sheer Heart Attack. What are the other ones? What's the other short one? Stone Cold Crazy. You know, they did some of the heaviest metal of the 70s.
And I think Queen 2 was a pretty influential record on a lot of those bands, probably.
Yeah. It's funny, you get it. You mentioned the word influence, though, and that thing has so many different layers of meaning. And Queen, I sometimes think they're more influential. The way the Beatles were influential, it's more like the magic of Queen and Freddie Mercury and inspiring you to go out and make music. But there's another form of influence. It's like whoever copied Queen, almost nobody. Whoever copied the Beatles, well, it's very abstract. Some bands did, but so there's a kind of influence that is a very direct influence where you could say, wow, you know, Judas Priest came along, and now in the history of heavy metal, we have probably 200 bands that sound like basically, you know, an improvement on Judas Priest, right? So, but it's funny, Queen as an influence it's more like, wow, they kick my ass. I mean, boy, I really want to learn how to play better to aspire to make art that great, but nobody copied Queen.
Well, who could?
Exactly. I mean, nobody really copied Zeppelin, you know. They copied little aspects of it. You can have your little ha-ha about, you know, Kingdom Come and a few bands and Coverdale Page or whatever. Like, there's this little basket of bands, but nobody really copies Led Zeppelin.
So do you have any, like, out of any of the more obscure records, what are some of your favorites as far as those go? Like, what would be the gems that you would pick out of some of the more obscure 70s stuff?
And especially like the earliest ones, maybe.
Wow. You know, I'm really that guy that calls almost every one of those overrated. But when pressed, I would lean towards, you know, we haven't mentioned Uriah Heep yet. That's not obscure. But I think the first Uriah Heep and the third Uriah Heep, Look at Yourself, are two cracking early heavy metal classics, right?
Yeah, Gypsy and Look at Yourself. And that's interesting how a lot of the early heavy stuff has so much organ incorporated into it, you know?
You know, I guess when pressed, I would say, you know, Atomic Rooster, Death Walks Behind You, the first Lucifer's Friend. I think it's maybe the second and third Buffalo. You know, a little bit of Sir Lord Baltimore, the first Bang. But again, none of them, you know, you just put them up in a blind taste test against Master of Reality. Like, forget it. I mean, they're just nothing. They sound like hokey, badly recorded, old school riffs, dated, dumb lyrics, not particularly trying to be all that heavy, because basically that's the reason that you know, some of these massive heavy metal albums are talked about in a massive way. There's very few that rose to the challenge. I mean, I guess one I would put up there is that first Montrose album, you know, 1973, amazing for that era. You have to stick up for that a little bit. I mean, everybody knows about it, granted, but, you know, you listen to that and you listen to Aerosmith's first album, and it's like kindergarten versus a master's program. I mean, Montrose, you would think, should have been huge, right?
Got it in me.
Moxie's first album, but you're talking 1975, I think, and that's a pretty heavy album for 1975. Tease's first album, to be Canadian about it, 1976, mm-hmm. is very heavy for 1976.
Yeah.
What else? You know, Hawkwind could be kind of heavy. But you know, I almost put up against these albums, and they should get credit because they're actually pre-Sabbath is the first Stooges album. The first MC5 album, Kick Out the Jams, is pretty darn heavy, right?
Yeah.
But it's by being live. The second Blue Cheer album is actually, I think, heavier and more closer to modern heavy metal than the first one, Outside Inside, or Inside Outside, or whatever it's called, right? And you mentioned Asterix. Yeah, that's pretty cool. There was what the heck is that one called? Not Still Life, but there's a pretty early kind of like kraut rocky, maybe even on Vertigo album that was pretty heavy. Remember Mark Sturacci's band Before Crocus?
They okay. could be pretty
heavy. Early Golden Earring, before anybody knew about them. There's a couple pretty heavy albums in there, 71, 72-ish, maybe even 70. Status Quo.
I love Status Quo, yeah.
Dude, Pile Driver. Basically, Pile Driver is the first one where they were really trying to shed
the psychedelic, know, yeah.
strict blues thing. But Pile Driver, Hello. I love the Quo album from 76. But again, you're late now, right? Rainbow's up and running. You know, so you get into the late 70s and you've actually got some albums that are totally heavy. But there's not very many from the early 70s that can hold a candle to Volume 4 and Mass Reality and Paranoid and in rock.
Well, Dave, what are some of your favorite obscure, heavy 70s records?
Well, some of the stuff, I kind of agree with Martin on a lot of it, is like, I like bits and pieces, but as a whole catalog of things, some of that stuff, like there's a lot of the Bang stuff that I like song-wise, but as a whole, sitting listening to it isn't. I just don't think there's enough there. I like the Toad stuff.
Right.
Yeah. When I started buying records, which would have been probably about 74, 75, which was pretty much Kiss at the time, and then Aerosmith, Sabbath, and The Sweet, which I think is some the Give Us a Wink album, which I think is totally heavy. And obviously the band Heathen liked them and they did Set Me Free. I think I got some Scorpions at that time too, so it was kind of like this is really good. So I don't know how I would have reacted at the time. But again, you know, we're talking, I'm 8, 9 years old. So
bring up good ones that should be on the record. So Sweet in 76, Scorpion, certainly a heavy album in 76 with Virgin Killer. Sweet with Sweet Fanny Adams in 74 is super heavy. Yeah. And let's not forget Nazareth in 73 and 74. And even their first album in 70. The second one was Mellow. It was a weird folky experiment.
Yeah.
But Nazareth in 70 has got some pretty heavy stuff on it. But Razzmanazz is a pretty heavy album for 73.
Yeah, sure. Too Bad, Too Sad. And then my favorite is probably Loud and Proud, but yeah, it's not as riffy. And then they got pretty riffy on Hair of the Dog.
Yeah.
I think one of the heaviest early albums from 1971 is that Leafhound album, Growers of Mushroom. That one is pretty heavy all the way through. Mm-hmm. And that's 71. But some of my favorite heavy stuff from the 70s goes more towards the mid-70s, I guess. One album I really love is the second album by Nitzinger, One Foot in History.
Oh, yeah.
I love that record. And there's some really heavy, really cool songs on there.
Yeah.
And the Good Rats is a band I like a lot that had some pretty metal-sounding songs on Tasty and Rat City and Blue. They also were a very eclectic band, but there were some great heavy songs by them in the mid-70s. And then, Martin, you already mentioned Buffalo a couple times, and I love them. But my favorite album by them is their third one, Only Want You for Your Body. Right. That's 74, and that record is good all the way through, every song. But yeah, they were great. But yeah, then you get into who heard Buffalo at the time. Did anybody even hear them when you talk about influential? But
yeah, and Mountain was pretty heavy for the very early 70s. Cactus was somewhat heavy, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, they're along the lines of a Nitzinger. Right?
Another really obscure band that was pretty heavy is Third World War.
Yeah,
you know them. They had some pretty heavy stuff, and that was 1970, 1971.
The signal coming down the line. Load your magazine clip. I load mine. Don't you know I feel proud? Just to shake your hand. Yeah, don't you know I feel proud? Just to make.
Yeah, Three Man Army, even Blood When Pig had some interesting stuff on it.
Oh, yeah, Three Man Army, that goes back to that band Gun. Yeah, that song, Race with the Devil, that song was pretty heavy, and that was the 60s.
And we're also missing Rush, I think, out of the whole thing. I think they were, at least on,
Caress of Steel.
Well, but like even the technical thrash stuff, I think we're progressive thrash. I mean, a lot of that took a lot from Rush, I think.
Yeah. But actually, later on. The self-titled debut in 74 is very heavy for 74 even.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, Rush were definitely a big influence, yeah.
Steve!
solve anything?
All right.
So yeah, I mean, to recap, I guess your question, I don't know what we solved, but I think it always comes down to the first Sabbath album invented it all. But if you want to take all of 1970, it's Paranoid and the first Sabbath and In Rock. And basically, I think heavy metal becomes something that you can define and taste, touch, sight, smell, all of that, basically for the first time with the new wave of British heavy metal.
Awesome.
And you say?
Yeah, I agree. It's yeah, really hard to gauge how influential anything was, I guess.
But I don't know if it's that hard. I mean, I think we know that the big famous bands with lots of catalog and who are super talented are really the bands that did most of the influencing. If you're a super fan of this stuff and you're a new wave British heavy metal band making music and you're a metal fanatic, you will know all this other stuff, but you will still, you know, your Thin Lizzy collection is still going to have way more influence on you than the one T album you happened to buy on that trip to Switzerland.
Agreed. Yeah. I think it's a matter of a lot of bands with, you know, getting different members. You know, Metallica's a great example. James Hetfield with his Aerosmith, Nugent, American kind of rock thing. And then you have Lars with the European, brings all the European kind of stuff in. And the melding of those two together kind of more what I think builds the bands than specifically a band to a band situation.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, when you look at 80s heavy metal, when you look at the American version of it and the European version, obviously it's the two very different sets of influences that made them so different. But then a band like Metallica set themselves apart in America because they brought in much more of the European influence, you know?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I don't want to get into this too much, but I mean, there's this whole idea that did Brian Slagle invent hair metal? And, you know, there's an interesting way of looking at it. It's like, you know, by being that fanatic, bringing in all those new wave of British heavy metal albums and then doing those Metal Massacre albums, I mean, those Metal Massacre albums are put together. They consist of bands that became regular heavy metal, hair metal, and thrash, and basically ignited an entire LA scene. So in a certain extent, I mean, your early bands like Rat and Quiet Riot and Dokken, I mean, they are essentially influenced by a lot of the bands Metallica would have been influenced by. And that's, you know, a nice little basket of the most famous new wave of British heavy metal bands, plus the heavier American bands from 5 years earlier, right? Your big triumvirate of your Kiss, Aerosmith, Ted, Blue Oyster Cult, right? And the big British behemoths. But basically, you know, in a funny way, all of metal in the 80s, where America took over and Britain died, basically all of that metal comes from Slagle and Lars's enthusiasm and Slagle working at Oz Records and all of them, you know, loving this new wave of British heavy metal stuff. And, you know, and guys coming out of these samplers, you know, Dokken guys, Rat guys, also Slayer guys and Metallica guys, but essentially those early samplers were like the root of all of it, you know, from the heaviest stuff to the most hair metal-y stuff.
Agreed.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Martin.
All right.
It was good talking to you.
Spend any time we can. I mean, I just had a new Iron Maiden book come out. I do have a Metallica book coming out eventually. I had a Rush book come out a couple months ago. So if you guys want to ever chat and do something more themed around one or two bands, I'm up to doing that too.
Cool. Yeah, and everyone listening should check out martinpopoff.com. They can get all your books there. And my favorites are probably the Collector's Guides to Heavy Metal, the 70s and 80s especially. And I love the Ye Olde Metal book, where you cover a lot of these obscure bands we're talking about, actually. So
yeah, those are pretty, you know, those are pretty low sellers. I mean, I just put out Ye Olde Metal 79, you know, but I basically, it's a total labor of love, and I'm hoping people eventually try to get them all kind of thing, because it is a tough thing to do. But, and I've also started taking those short essays and doing standalone ones as 98-cent ebooks, which you could get on iTunes now. There's about 20 of them.
And, oh, awesome.
And also at Zunier.com, which is a Canadian site. So you can get PDFs, Mobis, the EPUB version, whatever you want. So there's a lot that aren't in any of the Ye Olde Metal books, and there's a handful that are in the Ye Olde Metal books, but usually I've expanded them and added, you know, new footage and stuff. So,
yeah, I just read your Tooth and Nail one last week. And I have Sweet Fanny Adams and some other ones in the pipeline to read, so.
Yeah. Coming out shortly is Give Us a Wink, Off the Record, and Desolation Boulevard. And we're going to group them together as well in a certain way, I think.
Awesome.
Awesome, man.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Fun. And, anytime you want to do this again, let me know.
Okay.
I will. Thank you.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. Stay tuned for next week's episode when Fistful of Dave and I are going to play a lot more of the heaviest songs of the 70s. Until then, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with one of the most important bands in the development of heavy metal, in my opinion, UFO. This is a song off their first rock album with Michael Schenker on guitar, a song called Doctor Doctor. Until next time.
be back.
Oh, hell, I better get it. Hello?